Chapter 16. He wasn't dead, but damn near. Tien had used the serrated dinner knife from his hospital tray, and had utilized the flimsy blade to its worst advantage, planting it deep while twisting it upward and into Sizer Pretorius' kidney, then breaking it off, resulting in massive internal hemorrhage and partial paralysis. Fortunately, he had been attacked in the hospital, and we had him in surgery in less than 10 minutes. I'll call Marie, you call everybody else, and get an APB out on my truck. He's got Sancho's gun, so make sure they know he's armed, then get over to the office and coordinate. Who's everybody else? We stood by the swinging doors. Vic, the Ferg, Ruby, Double Tough, the Highway Patrol, Natrona County, Campbell County, Sheridan County, and if there's a Canadian Mountie on duty, I want him on it, too. What about Henry? I looked up at Freymeyer, at his battered face and broken arm, still cradling to Yen's computer. Especially Henry. I started toward the emergency room exit and noticed that something continued to block the fluorescent light in the hallway over my shoulder. I turned and looked at Virgil. How had I forgotten about a 7-foot Indian? I pointed at Freymeyer, who was making his calls from the nursing station. Virgil, could you go with him? He didn't move, but studied me and then strained to get the words out.
You need help.
I stared at him. I'm about to get a lot of it. I looked into the haloed reflections in his pupils and could tell that it cost a lot for him to speak.
You need help now.
Other than shoot him, there wasn't a lot I could do to stop him, and maybe I was ashamed that I had him locked up for almost a week with barely any cause, but I didn't have time for this. Look, I appreciate the offer, but
I know that country.
I looked up and felt like a child arguing with an adult, the medicine bag on his chest at my eye level. What?
You are going to Bailey, the ghost town. I know it better than anyone.
What makes you think that I'm going...
The silver-haired woman. She said the electric messages were coming from the school.
It took me a second to make the connection. The emails?
Yes.
I thought about it. They were coming from the wireless, whatever it is, of the county school system. He nodded.
The electric messages from the BPS.
His eyes darkened, reflecting everything, showing nothing.
It is the same abbreviation that is on a plaque they have on the outside of the building. I have seen it while watching the children. BPS. Bailey Public School.
It was like I was falling from the earth. It all fit. The random emails, the missing computer that was of such interest to Tuyen, the appearance of the second girl, the fact that Ho Ti didn't bear much of a resemblance to my Kim. The real great-granddaughter of the woman I knew in Tan Son Nhut was in Bailey, and had been desperately trying to get in touch with me the only safe way she knew how.
She is there, and we must find her before he does.
Once I'd called Marie and asked Doc Bloomfield to update me on Santiago's condition, Virgil and I were in the old Suburban and on the road. I radioed in to give everyone an indication as to our location and destination, and it was Rosie who responded. Static. Damn it, I'm I-90, east of Durant, but I'm turning around now. I'll call ahead to the Casper detachment and send them north. I keyed the mic. Roger that. Virgil continued to watch the road ahead. I flattened my foot on the accelerator and listened as the big block made like Big Daddy Don Garlitz. She was old, but in a straight line, the 454 cubic inches was some kind of fierce. 30 minutes later, we took the exit at Powder Junction and shot west toward the south tail of the Bighorns and Bailey. Virgil braced a hand that nearly covered the dash as I made the corner before dropping over the hill to where we had a clear view of the abandoned town. I was hoping to see my truck parked in the main and only drag of the old mining community, or at the school just over the hill. But the only vehicle I saw was the turquoise and white Ford that belonged to the Dunnigan brothers. I stopped the truck and tried to decide if I should continue to the school or head down and see what was up with Den and James. I decided to check on the brothers and turned the wheel. I pulled up alongside their truck and got out.
Virgil opened the passenger side door and stood in the middle of the street as I looked inside the pickup. The rifle rack was empty. Otherwise, everything seemed normal, and the keys were dangling from the ignition. I felt the hood, and the warmth from the engine was still there, but could see no signs of my truck, the brothers, Tuyen, or the missing girl. It didn't make sense. The Dunnigans, but no Tuyen? It was obvious that Virgil was reading my mind as he circled around and joined me.
You check the school, and I'll stay here.
I thought about it, and then looked up and down the deserted street. Virgil, I can't...
You must find the girl.
They're liable to shoot you. He opened the driver's side door and pushed me into the Suburban before I could voice any further objections. He stood there looking down at me and smiled as he shut the door. He rested his giant hand on the knife at his belt.
I have been shot before.
Tan Son Nhut, Vietnam, 1968. I lay there on the floor of the personnel carrier and thought that it sure hurt a lot to be dead. I stared up through the open hatchway and watched the sickly lemon color of the sky as the sun fought to bring more heat to the Southeast Asian morning. I could hear helicopter support coming in from Tan Son Nhut, and I watched as the Huey gunships shot in and through the sky above. The 9mm slug had taken part of the clavicle and a lot of meat with it, and it was all I could do to stay aware and watch as Baranski climbed through the opening of the APC. He continued to point the Walter at my face. My head was lodged against the bulkhead and the driver's station, with my left arm pinned behind me. I made a futile kick at him as he stood over me. The CID man watched the helicopters fly overhead. Regas, bypass, and haul ass. That'd be the Troop D gunships, and I'd say that means the end of Charlie's little Tet surprise. Baranski propped a foot up on the seat and studied me with an indifferent look on his face. Damn, you can't hit shit with these homemade silencers. I choked out a response, figuring the more time I took, the more of a chance there was that somebody would show up. You hit me. Yeah, but I was aiming between your eyes. He laughed. You should have stayed at BHQ, dumbass. It would have been a lot safer there. I grimaced as another stab from my shoulder caught my breath in my throat. So, it was your operation? He pulled the pack of Camels from his shirt pocket and bumped one, placing it between his lips. It became mine. He redeposited the pack and pulled out the Zippo and lit up. It was kind of a ragtag operation, but it held promise. He inhaled deeply and looked down at me again. I'm pulling in almost $100,000 a month, and I was going to cut you in, but you were so fucking gung-ho. Huang was your partner? He sniffed and cleared his throat before taking another long drag on the cigarette. Yeah, and he's going to be hard to replace. The satchels were a hell of an operation. I could get anything, hashish, opium, whatever anyone wanted. I could get it, and even better, I could get it out and back to the land of the great PX. I'll have to get another pilot for this route, but that really shouldn't be that much of a problem. He studied me and laughed. All the trouble started when that stupid bitch decided to tell you about the deal. Do you believe that? All this because of some fucking putain. He took another drag and considered me. We can talk as long as you want, because there's nobody coming. Charlie Troop is over at the Ville shooting prisoners right now. His eyes were uncaring, and he palmed the 9mm as he spoke. You see, Mr. Marine Investigator, nobody gives a shit. I tried to readjust my position, but wedged in the walkway, there wasn't anywhere to go. What about Mendoza? The Beaner? What about him? It hurt just to breathe, but I had to keep talking. Was he in on it? Nah, I had him pretty much trained to look the other way. The only thing was I figured he'd get suspicious if I fragged you. He pulled the cigarette from his mouth and spit out a piece of tobacco from his tongue. He was pretty torn up from the wreck, so I just walked over and put one in the back of his head. Put him out of my misery. Kind of like I'm going to do to you. I'm glad that I didn't kill you the first time. It's nice that I get to see you, see your expression when I shoot you in the face. The Walter came back up and leveled at my eyes. Look at me, not a scratch. You know, they say that George Washington was like that. Patton, too. There'd be a battle with bullets zipping around all over the place, and they'd never get touched. He smiled again, and I watched as his finger tightened on the trigger. Like them, I guess I'm just fucking lucky that way. The blast of the gun sounded like two, and the blood sprayed everywhere. I lay there for a moment thinking that I shouldn't be thinking. I blinked and looked up through the blood on Baranski's face, at his lips, where the cigarette continued to hang just before he toppled over and landed on top of me. He shuddered once and then lay still. I looked up at the one-eyed sergeant who was seated against the bulkhead and still holding the AK-47 with a thin trailing of smoke drifting from the barrel. His voice had a sing-song quality to it, just before his single eye closed again. "I guess your fucking luck just ran out, asshole." There was no one at the school. I pulled into the driveway and got out, pulling the mag light from the pocket in the door, along with the handheld two-way radio. The batteries were weak in the flashlight, but it provided more illumination than the listless moon that was just rising. I listened to the soft tinging of the hardware against the flagpole and remembered the school on the Powder River that I'd attended. I walked up to the front door of the single-story concrete block building and saw that it was padlocked. I peered through the window and could see a couple of desks and a computer on a side table. Abandoned for summer, it looked like no one had been in the place in a couple of months. I sighed and glanced around, hoping to see a Vietnamese girl somewhere in the High Plains night. I was disappointed. I punched the button on the radio and looked up at the red cliffs that seemed to soak up the light of the moon. "Absaroka County Sheriff's Department, this is Unit 1. Is anybody out there?" Static. Damn cliffs. I drove over the hill back to Bailey and parked the Suburban in front of the Dunnigan's old Ford. I climbed out with the flashlight in my hand again. This time, someone was sitting in the driver's seat. I pulled my .45 and shined the dimming flashlight into the cab. I recognized the profile and spoke through the open passenger side window. "James?" He turned to look at me as I trailed my sidearm below the window where he couldn't see it. "Hey, Walt." I waited a second and then lowered the beam of the maglite, but he didn't continue. "What are you doing here, James?" He took a deep breath, pushed his straw hat back, and sipped from a tarnished flask. I could see the 30-30 lever action propped up next to the door. "Oh, I was heading back from the bar and come looking for that girl, the dead one." I studied him and then rested an elbow on the door to strike a more conversational posture. "What's the Winchester for?" He smiled and looked embarrassed. "This place, it kind of worries me. I guess I'm getting scary. You mind if I take it?" He studied the rifle, then me. "Sure, sure. Nothing to be afraid of if you're here." I carefully reached in and pulled the Winchester through the window, threw the lever a couple of times to empty it, and then shuttled it and the loose rounds onto the floorboard of the Suburban. I locked the truck and watched James, who hadn't moved except to drink from the flask. "You find her?" He took a breath to give himself time to think and then shook his head. "No, no, no." He stared at the dash as we listened to the soft tick of the big block cooling on my vehicle. He extended the flask toward me, and I could smell the trademark brandy. "Care for some?" "No, thanks." I shook my head. "James, have you seen anybody else around here?" He brought the flask back to his lips and took a swallow, then brought a finger up and touched the shift knob on the old truck. "You know, most people don't believe the things I tell them." He turned his head and looked at me. "So I just stopped telling them." His eyes wavered a little, and I noticed he was looking past me and to the right. I turned and followed his gaze, but there was no one there. Do you know you're being followed? I turned and looked again, but still couldn't see anyone.
Now?
All the time. He took another sip from the flask, and his eyes returned to the dash. They're with you all the time, or all the times I've ever seen you. I continued to study him, but he didn't move. Met a giant. It took me a second to respond.
You did?
Yep. Real big Indian fella.
And where was that?
He leaned forward and peered through the top of the windshield. I followed his gaze past the graveyard and above the rock shelf at the end of town.
Up there.
I pushed off with the Colt still camouflaged beside my leg.
Thanks, James.
That big Indian, he brought me back down here, took my keys, and told me to stay in my truck. His look trailed up toward the Union Hall. I offered him my saddle gun, but he said he liked to work quiet.
I nodded and turned to continue up the street where the edge of the moon was just beginning to clear the cliffs. They looked black, the way blood does in moonlight.
Hey, Walt! I stopped and looked back at him through the reflection of the vent window.
Yep.
Is that big Indian a friend of yours?
I thought about it.
Yes, he is.
He cast a glance up the street and then back to me.
Is he?
I waited, but the drunken man who saw things that nobody else saw just continued studying me.
Is he what?
He took another slug of the brandy and then turned to look back up the hill.
Is he dead, too?
I sure hope not. I started to grin, but it wouldn't take.
Stay in the truck, James.
He nodded.
I will.
I walked up the street with those feathers of anxiety scouring the insides of my lungs as I checked each dilapidated building. I still saw no sign of Virgil, Tuyen, or the girl. A ghost town, and, except for James and me, deserted. It was like the place was swallowing souls. I saw a glimmer of something beside the collapsed wall of the saloon and eased myself down the wooden boardwalk far enough to see the nose of my truck. I took a breath and raised my Colt. Staying next to the crumbling wall, I slipped in behind the bullet and saw that the doors were locked and the keys were gone. I pulled the two-way from my belt and gave it another try.
Unit 1, anybody copy?
Static. I looked up past the cemetery to the Union Hall at the castellated cornices and second-story outcropping that gave it the appearance of a fortress standing on the hill. The still listless moon was at a full quarter, and I could see that the sickle-like point had just cleared the cliffs. I started the climb, keeping the .45 in front of me. I was unconcerned about the rattlesnakes since the evening was cool and they'd likely be sleeping in the crevices of the stone outcroppings off to the right, attempting to glean the last bit of the day's warmth that was still held by the rocks. I paused at the cemetery and laid a hand on the steel railing, looked up at the dark windows, and then peered up at the path. In the darkness, it would be difficult to see if anyone had passed. The steps appeared the same, but as I tipped my hat back for a better view, I could see the door to the Union Hall was open. I knew that I had closed it. The sweat at the middle of my back had adhered my uniform shirt to my spine, and I shivered in the cooling breeze. It was a steep climb, and I took a few deep inhales to steady my breathing. I stood at the doorway and looked down the shotgun hall, past what used to be officers and into the gloom of the back rooms. I could see the size 13 swirls my rubber-soled ropers had left in the heavy dust from my previous visit. And there was an obvious trail where I had gone farther into the building and then doubled back to go up the stairs to the dance hall. Barely visible, inside my boot prints, were a set of well-defined, high-arched,
tiny footprints exactly tracing my tracks. I stepped into the entryway and led with the 45. She had continued up, carefully placing her bare feet inside mine. I shifted my weight, clicked off my radio, and stared up the stairs, then climbed as quietly as I could. It was useless. I sounded like a collection of squeals and creaks ascending. I paused at the landing and looked at the dance hall floor. The wavering moonlight cast across the flat surface and illuminated our joined tracks like pools of liquid mercury. I eased myself further up the steps and took hold of the railing at the top. The old upright piano sat on the stage, alone. Standing room only, and nobody there. The moon suddenly decided to take an interest, and the full force of its shine spread through the bay windows at the front of the hall, through the half-glass doorway that led to the balcony beyond, and across the dance floor in a blue light of growing rectangular proportions. I stepped up onto the floor, my eyes following the tiny footprints that had continued in mine as they crossed the room, up the three steps to the right, and across the stage. I trained the colt from corner to corner and then approached the proscenium arch. She had stopped at the piano. I placed my empty hand on the lip of the elevated area and hoisted a boot onto the edge, effectively, if not gracefully, taking the stage. There were no more footprints. It was as if she'd walked there and then, not so simply, had disappeared. The cover was open, and I could see the dust on the hammers of the keys that I hadn't played, and a new accumulation on the ones that I had. She hadn't touched the keys. The bench was still under the piano. There were no fingerprints on it, no sign that she had sat there. I nudged it out a little bit, put the 45 next to me, and sat, half facing the dance floor. I extended a forefinger and touched an F. The off-key sound almost reverent in the empty hall. I thought Moonglow would be appropriate, but changed my mind, thinking that I should play A Good Man Is Hard to Find for my Kim's great-granddaughter. I played an octave lower than it was written in an attempt to stay within the narrow confines of the soundboard. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but after playing a few stanzas, I heard a noise to my left. I picked up the colt and turned with it extended to see that a small trapdoor had risen about 4 inches at center stage. I stopped playing, and my breathing was the only sound in the room. The door in the floor slowly and silently shut. I noticed that the footprints leading past the trapdoor were slightly smudged. She must have retraced them and retreated exactly upon them. I lowered my sidearm to my knee, turned back toward the piano, and placed my free hand back over the keyboard, plinking the F again as a starting point. I played the melody this time with one hand, and after a few seconds, the trapdoor rose again, allowing me a view of the small fingers that had pushed it. I continued to play one-handed, then turned back, set the 45 on the bench, and allowed my left to join my right. I thought about Vietnam, and about how I'd filled the empty evenings at the Boy Howdy Bo Koo Good Times Lounge with Fats Waller. Like a snake charmer, I played the song that my Kim must have told her daughter about, and about which she must have told her daughter in turn. I played a smooth and steady version that left off with a trilling finish. I sat there, unmoving, until I couldn't stand it any longer, and turned. She stood beside the trapdoor that was in the stage floor. She was tiny, and she wore a cheap slip dress that perversely made her look even more like a child. Her black hair was long and tangled, and it covered part of her face so that I could only see one of her dark eyes. She held a laptop close to her chest. Her thin arms crossed its lid, and she looked like a computer with a head and legs. She didn't move, and I found a word sliding up my throat and filling my mouth. Hello. She still didn't move, but her head inclined just a little.
Hi.
I smiled and steadied the 45 on my knee. She stepped back, and I raised the other hand in reassurance. Wait, I'm not going to hurt you. She stood there, silent again. I've been looking for you, and I think you've been looking for me. Her weight shifted, but that was all. She looked like my Kim.
What's your name?
Her name is Ngoloy Kim. I snatched up the Colt and leveled it at Tuyen's half-hidden face, as he stood there on the last step of the stairs with his own arm extended. In his hand was Sizer Vittoria's Glock, and it was pointed directly at the girl. I'd neither seen nor heard him. Ngoloy Kim dove for the trap door and scratched for the inset handle, but when it wouldn't open, she scrambled to the back wall and crouched against the floorboards. She held the computer like a shield in front of her and whimpered, terrified. I was off the piano bench and had taken a step toward the edge of the stage. You're under arrest. He took the last step from the darkness, and with the moonlight raising shadows across his legs, his voice seemed disembodied. I'm willing to make you a deal.
I don't deal. Drop the weapon.
Try to shoot me, and I shoot her. He didn't move. The girl for the laptop. I stared down at him and could see his muscles straining the sleeve of his leather jacket. I figured the only thing to do was shoot. His weapon was pointed at her chest, and chances were he'd hit her, but it was possible that my first shot would be on target and would do more damage than his responding fire. I could feel the weight of the big Colt in my hand. What if I missed? What if he didn't? I was willing to take those types of chances with my own life, but not hers. I thought about who she was and what she'd gone through, all to find me. Talk. It was the only way. O.T. wasn't your granddaughter.
No.
I swallowed and prepared myself for any opening that might present itself.
Did you kill her or did Maynard?
He looked at me.
He did.
I didn't believe him for a moment. Philip Maynard hadn't been the type, but Tran Van Tuyen was.
Okay, let's say that's the truth. Then why kill him?
His gun hand stayed steady, and he was focused on the whimpering girl at the wall. He'd had the better part of a week to get to know me, and he'd done his homework well. He knew that I wouldn't endanger her.
He committed suicide, as you said.
You're lying. He glanced at me.
One of the ranchers, Mr. Dunnigan.
You're still lying. I am to assume from this that the bent bottle caps didn't succeed in misdirecting you?
No.
It was a habit Philip Maynard informed me of. He actually smiled and finally took a breath. Philip was actually blackmailing me. He was supposed to retrieve the girls and, more importantly, the computer. He made a mess of it and killed Hoti. I suppose he thought that if he planted the girl near the culvert and threw the purse in with the Indian, there wouldn't be any questions. I assume he was counting on a preconceived prejudice.
So you drugged him, just like Rene Paquette, and hung him?
He didn't say anything. The unspoken truth lay there between us like a bad smell. And I started formulating a new plan in hopes that he'd become so agitated with me